This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Elections in Iraq and the Palestinian territories, demonstrations in Lebanon, municipal elections in Saudi Arabia, the possibility of a contested presidential election in Egypt. Most countries of the Middle East are still a long way away from the ideals of representative democracy, the rule of law, and a free press, but there can be no doubt that change is in the air. In a few minutes, we'll talk with democracy activists from Lebanon, Syria, and Saudi Arabia about what's happening in those countries and why. Did the election in Iraq act as a catalyst? How much of this change is real and how much cosmetic? Is democracy gaining in the war of ideas that underlies the war on terror? Later in the program, we'll talk with the Cairo publisher of American-style comic books with Arab superheroes. But first, democracy in the Middle East. If you have questions about what's happening in Lebanon, Egypt, or Saudi Arabia, if you're from those countries, or if you've been there lately, call and tell us what changes you've seen. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Max Rodenbeck joins us now from Beirut, Lebanon. He's the Middle East correspondent for The Economist magazine. His article, Democracy Stirs, appears in the current issue. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, nice to be here.
To what extent are these various things isolated events, or is this a pattern that you could see across the region?
Well, there's certainly a pattern that's distinguishable. All of these countries are quite different in terms of their forms of government and so on. But, I mean, there is definitely a general situation across the Middle East, which is the least democratic part of the world. And there's certainly a trend towards an expansion of public participation in politics.
As you point out in your article, there has been democratic reforms in Bahrain, Morocco, a lot of places in the Middle East long before the elections in Iraq. To what extent do you think that event has acted as a catalyst?
Well, it's difficult to say exactly, but certainly the sight of so many people risking their lives to go out and vote has had a sort of catalytic impact. It's important what's happened in Iraq, but it's also important the way that people are able to follow things. I mean, it might be that... for example, the spread of satellite television and the fact that all this can be seen in real time is actually as important as the actual event of elections in Iraq.
Because media in many Arab countries is controlled by the government, and this is uncontrolled media that they're watching.
That's right, exactly.
Are these substantial democratic reforms, or in some cases is this just window dressing?
In most cases, the reforms are not yet particularly substantial, but the window is definitely open towards wider-ranging changes, and there is a sense in a very broad way across the general Arab public that the time is ripe for change.
Even in the cases where these changes are cosmetic, once you start this ball rolling, it can develop momentum of its own.
That's very much true. I mean, an example of that might be Egypt, where President Mubarak has recently announced that they're going to open the door to multi-candidate presidential elections. The actual selection process of who can run for a candidate hasn't been decided yet, and there are obviously going to be all kinds of conditions on the presidential elections. On the other hand, what that means is that one could say that this is just a cosmetic exercise. But on the other hand, it opens a horizon for further change and kind of stimulates the appetite for change.
As you also pointed out in your article, there are similar kinds of presidential elections held in other North African Arab countries in Algeria, Tunisia, that aren't really any threat to the ruling establishment.
That's right. I mean, it's one of the things that can be noticed in almost all Arab countries is that the power of the state and the ruling elite is extremely strong for various reasons. One of them is that in a lot of cases, the state actually has control of oil revenues, which means that they don't have to rely on taxing the public, which means that they don't have to worry about bargaining with the public about how to spend that money. I mean, there's no, it's a taxation without representation question.
The other thing you pointed out is the elections in the Palestinian territories, Iraq, and what's happening in Lebanon. One of the things that those countries do have in common is they are all, to one extent or another, occupied.
That is true, yes. Although I don't know if that is really significant. I mean, in the case of Iraq, obviously, the elections could never have been held of this kind under Saddam Hussein's regime. And in Palestine, there have been elections of one kind or another for quite a long time. And in Lebanon's case, Lebanon was a flourishing democracy way back in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, up until its civil war that started in 1975. And it seems more to be returning to its old model than to be creating something new.
We're talking about the winds of democratic reform in the Middle East. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's get a call in. This is Mahsoud from Denver, Colorado.
Hi, Neil. My name is Mahmoud. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just have a comment about, like, Morocco, which is right now undergoing huge changes. Basically, the government is admitting the mistakes of the past, and they're talking with the people about it. So it's a huge step because they're admitting about the killings and political persecutions going back to the 1950s, and it's unprecedented in the Arab world. And I just would like your comment about it.
Max Rodenbecker, do we overlook Morocco?
We may have overlooked Morocco, indeed. No, it's in some ways the changes in Morocco are more profound and far-reaching than in any other Arab country, and they haven't been occurring under occupation of any kind. It's a really proper kind of democratic evolution, not some kind of sudden revolution.
And
Morocco, which, yeah,
and an organic one, is I think what you're saying.
That's right. Yes.
Mahmoud, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
And Max Rodenbecker, I know you're on deadline. We appreciate you taking the time this evening to talk with us.
Thank you.
Max Rodenbecker is the Middle East correspondent for The Economist magazine and joined us from Beirut in Lebanon. Joining us now to talk about recent unrest in Lebanon is Ziad Barood. He is Secretary General of the Lebanese Association for Democratic Elections, and he joins us also from Beirut. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. Good evening.
Protests after the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri led to the resignation of Prime Minister Omar Karami's government. Then today, Karami was named to lead the new government. Is this a setback?
Well, it's something related to the internal way of doing business. And I think it has nothing to do with what the opposition groups succeeded in maintaining in the streets since the assassination of former Premier Hariri. So I think it has nothing to do with the streets. It has nothing to do with what the opposition groups are trying to maintain throughout the 20 days since then. And I believe it's going to continue in this in the same trend, hopefully.
Yet it would seem to have to be a disappointment to those who in the opposition who organized to overthrow the man.
It is not, because so far the opposition demands were clear: the withdrawal of the Syrian troops and fair and free elections. And so far, the Syrians decided to withdraw from Lebanon. They started leaving as of yesterday. And free elections are hopefully will take place in 1 month or two. So it's not a great disappointment, because we believe that if President Karami will share the new cabinet, it depends on the team he will be dealing with, and it depends on whom he will be the team he will choose to help him in his new mission.
You've been quoted as saying that the success of the opposition in terms of reflecting all of Lebanon. It won't be successful unless it can bring in the Shiite community. Yesterday, there was, as you know, an enormous demonstration there in Beirut of Hezbollah supporters rallying in support of Syria. To what extent does that affect the situation, do you think?
Well, the rally supporting Syria, Hezbollah succeeded in organizing yesterday, is not necessarily something bad. I mean, you can see it as something representative, and we believe that everybody in Lebanon should feel free to express himself openly and freely. What the demonstrators tried to say yesterday, and regardless of their number, of the from where they came, etc., I think it was good to say, well, there are two opinions in this regard, and it's not something we don't see as positive. The bad thing is that the Shia community is like taken as being not into the democratic process towards a free Lebanon, but it is not true. But the problem is that Hezbollah is a big political group, including in 99% of its members are Shia. So that's why some people are saying that the Shia community is not participating in the process of independence and free Lebanon. I think that Hezbollah can participate and can be a leading partner in this process, provided he can be free of deciding what to do. The main problem Hezbollah is facing is his alliance with Syria and Iran, and that's why we have to take this fact into consideration.
Ziad Baroud, we know it's late there in the evening in Beirut. We thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Ziad Baroud is Secretary General of the Lebanese Association for Democratic Elections, and he joined us on the phone from Beirut in Lebanon. We're talking with democratic activists in the Middle East. When we come back, we'll hear from people fighting for political openness in Egypt and in Saudi Arabia, and of course, more of your calls. 800-989-8255, email totn@npr.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about democracy movements in the Middle East this hour with some of the activists involved in them. And we want your questions and comments. If you're hearing from people working for democracy in Lebanon, Egypt, or Saudi Arabia, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Igor. Igor is calling from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Oh, hi, Neil.
Hi.
I followed with a great excitement the recent events in the Middle East, just like I followed the democracy movements in the 90s that were happening where I'm from, and that is Balkans and former Yugoslavia. And I just can't help myself but draw some parallels between them. And I have certain concerns that just like the Balkan people were oppressed for the longest time and then finally had an opportunity for free elections and freedom of speech, and then that was 10 years ago. And very little has changed, the freedom of speech and just the culture, political culture between people has not changed very much in the last 10 years. I would like to ask your panel what they think about that parallel. What are some plans when that democracy actually comes in? What are the plans to change the mentality of people, and are they absolutely positive that all sides are included into discussion, including Hamas and including Sunni population in Iraq and so forth?
Yes, it's a good point, Igor, and I'll put it to some of our guests. Thank you for calling. Joining us now is Naeem Sherbini of the Cairo-based Ibn Khaldun Center for the Development, and he joins us from Northern Virginia. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
President Hosni Mubarak recently announced a constitutional change that would allow others to challenge him and run against him for president. How significant is this?
On the face of it, it looks good. The problem is with the fine print. Egypt's present constitution goes back really to 1956, which was tailor-made for Egypt's president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who is a very strong dictator. And there has been since then really great powers given to the president, and for Hosni Mubarak to focus only on one article, Article 76 of the Constitution, to say we're going to change that. Well, there are about 14 other articles that also need to be changed, because Egypt's president, according to its constitution, is all powerful and very much akin to the ancient god king of ancient Egypt. So for him to say, all right, I'm picking up the one item that the United States has made such fuss about, and I'll change that, but the rest of the articles in the Constitution remain the same, giving him all powers, seems to be some kind of really, he's dancing around the issue, basically.
You said he was talking about the one issue the U.S. was complaining about. Is this in response, do you think, to American pressure?
I believe it was, because the foreign minister, Mr. Applegate, was here in early February. And for a while, whenever our American policymakers talk with him about democracy, he responds to them with talk about peace in the Middle East and Egypt's role. So, you know, they really had to make it very clear that there is no more linkage between that. The United States is not going to look the other way while Egypt violates the civil liberties of its citizens in return for Egypt's participation in the peace process. So that linkage has come to an end during the foreign minister's visit. That's the first thing. The second is that Washington was evidently very determined to send a message to Mr. Mubarak that, look, you've been in power for 24 years, and we want to see some change. And as a matter of fact, this reflects the very will of the Egyptian people. There has been increased demonstrations in the street. The opposition parties are getting together. The socio-political conditions in the country have been declining since the 1990s. The worsening conditions really is not in the interest of anybody. It's not in the interest of Egypt or Egyptians. It's not in the interest of United States either, because we know from September 11 and from the active international terrorist movement that there has been there a fairly substantial Egyptian elements there. So it's really in nobody's interest to let things continue to deteriorate.
Let's get a caller on the line. And this is Anter, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Tallahassee.
That is correct.
Go ahead.
I am an Egyptian-American, and I am very happy to hear about the news about the possibility, even the possibility of getting free elections, free presidential elections in Egypt. My question to the you and perhaps your guests is the following. Is there anything beyond the bursts of talk that we hear from in the media from in one day to the other, that any real thing that the United States can really do, without occupying Egypt, of course, to promote the new democracies there? And the other part of my question is how the production of these new democracies, genuine democracies in the Middle East, impact the way the United States view and deals with that part of the world. And the reason I'm asking this second part of the question is that the United States has been the greatest supporters of the greatest dictatorships in that part of the world, which is Saudi Arabia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Your response, Naeem Sherbini?
Thank you, Neil. Yes, the United States does have in its power a very important or a very potent tool of policy dialogue, and that is aid to the tune of about $2 billion every year since the peace treaty with Israel was concluded back in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
That has been an oracle of faith between Egypt and the United States. And I think, you know, after 25, 26 years of continued pouring of American aid, it's time for the United States to say, hey, wait a minute, what exactly is it that we're getting for our money? And if indeed Washington is serious about having this push for democracy throughout the world, then there is no question that Egyptian policies, especially under Mr. Mubarak, have not been consistent with American objectives, mm-hmm. Whether in the Middle East or elsewhere. Let's not forget that Mr. Mubarak himself has emerged in the last couple of years as the most stubborn opponent to the spread of democracy in the Middle East.
Egyptians, like everyone else in the world, saw those Iraqis going out to vote in various places across that country. What effect did that have in Egypt?
Well, it has emboldened Egyptians. Now they see long lines of women in Iraq having voted, very proud of it, having taken a lot of danger. They felt, my gosh, we had better do something, and hence there is a new movement in Egypt called Kifaya, which means enough. People have gone out in the streets, and especially around Cairo University a few weeks ago, shouting enough is enough. Unfortunately, they were only in the hundreds. They were surrounded by thousands of security forces. The power of the state in Egypt has been quite enormous, and it derives from the fact that the army has been in power since 1952. However, given the decline in the socioeconomic conditions and the large-scale unemployment and the weakening of the Egyptian pound, all of these factors have definitely diminished Egyptians' standards of living. And so people, in a sense, are beginning to think, what have we got to lose? Let us go in the street, let us demonstrate, and let us do something to change the mindset of policymakers in Cairo.
Let's get another caller on the line. Ibrahim joins us from here in Washington.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
My name is Ibrahim Hussein. I live here in Washington. I'm glad to hear the voice of my good friend, Naeem Sherbini.
Hi, Ibrahim.
Hello, Naeem. I just arrived from Egypt last week, and I was in the demonstration against Hosni Mubarak. And I really think his move to change one article of the Constitution, the way Naeem described it, is not sufficient, because the Constitution itself requires additional changes. In addition to that, we need to consider the ability to campaign and to have a real election without the emergency laws. Any five people cannot meet publicly without the government permission. So they need some adjustment of the emergency laws, or drop it at least temporarily during the election.
Let me ask you both.
The other thing is the access to the media. The media is government control, and you cannot really have good election while one side or one candidate have control of the media.
Let me ask you both, if there were truly free elections in Egypt, some people worry that a fundamentalist government might be elected, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, that has been the traditional bogeyman, Neil, and the truth is that most knowledgeable observers in Cairo and elsewhere would put the size of the Islamists, that is, the various shades of Islamist groups from the moderate Muslim Brotherhood to the jihadists, they would put that anywhere between 20 and 25%. Now, 20 to 25% is not going to make that much change in the overall picture. However, the most important thing here is that if, in fact, all the groups are given a chance to compete in an open level field, a lot of observers would say Hosni Mubarak would still win, but only by about 60%, maximum 65%, which I believe would be a heck of a lot better for Egypt's image, for Mr. Mubarak himself, and for the future of democracy in Egypt to win at 60% than winning at the ridiculous 95%.
Ibrahim, thanks very much for the phone call.
In addition, I'd like to make one more comment.
If you could make it quick.
In addition to what Naeem said, I think the Egyptian people are aware of what happened in Iran. And the Muslim experience in Iran, all the instability and the failure of the traditional, really unfair to Islam model, have been learned by other Muslim and Arab countries, including Egypt. And the Egyptians are really reluctant to go with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Ibrahim, thanks for the phone
call. Thank you.
We're talking today about democracy movements in the Middle East. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Saudi Arabia will soon hold its first municipal elections in 40 years. When they do, Saudi businesswoman Nadia Bakhrji will not be on the ballot. She was one of the first female political candidates in Saudi history, but withdrew her name after the government banned women from running for office or voting, at least this time around. Nadia Bakhrji joins us now from her home in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and it's good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Yes, hello, good evening.
How much of a disappointment was it to find out that women would not be allowed to vote or run for office in this set of elections?
Well, of course, you can imagine it was very disappointing because we were quite optimistic about it. And all the indicators were quite positive that we would get a chance to participate from the start.
I've looked at some of the things that you were hoping to talk about in these elections, women's issues, children's issues, issues of infrastructure, sewage. This doesn't seem radical, though the idea of a woman running for office, to some in Saudi Arabia, that does seem radical.
Well, yeah, I think my platform was quite human. It was quite relevant. It was relevant to the community issues that we are all experiencing across Saudi Arabia. There were issues that relate to family life and to communities, having community centers and trying to create a better environment for families and for women. But yes, I believe that my participation and seat on the council would have added value and would have given a different dimension to the other candidates, I think, or the other members of the council. I think women have a lot to contribute.
Why do you think the Saudi government, the royal family there, decided to hold elections now?
Well, I think it was long coming. I don't think it was a sudden decision because a lot of decisions in Saudi Arabia are taken, they're studied very gradually. We have had municipality elections before, 40 years previously, in the western region. They have been trying to slowly get the people to be more participant in the political process. I mean, we do have higher council, which meets regularly, and the higher council is elected. Allocated seats. These people are representative of certain sectors of society, and they come forward with initiatives to the government. They are not royals. So that was the move in the right direction. That was a few years back that they allowed the higher council. And now they are trying to introduce, I don't know if you'd like to call it democracy, because at the end of the day, we have to say we do have a monarchy. This is a monarchist system. And I think in the end that it's more to say, all right, we want to empower society. We want to get them more involved with the decision-making process. So that's a move in the right direction, I guess.
Yet a long way from actually giving power to the people.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you have to consider that giving power to the people overnight is not in the best interest of our country. I mean, at the end of the day, the whole democratic process has to be introduced gradually. There has to be a certain education has to be part of the educating system. The culture of democracy is not something you can just start off, in 24 hours. You've got to really introduce it gradually.
We're going to have to take...
Not only that, you have to do that. You know why? Because you have to get the...
Well, we're having trouble with the phone line, and we have to take a short break. We hope we can clear up both of those things when we come back. We'd also like to welcome more of your calls, 800-989-8255. And we'll also be talking about a superhero action in Arab comic books when we come back. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. Now let's continue our discussion of democracy in the Middle East. In a few minutes, we'll move from the ballot box to the comic book racks to look at the new wave of Arab comic books. Our guest is businesswoman and one-time Saudi political candidate Nadia Bakhirji, who joins us on the phone from Riyadh. Also still with us is Naib Sherbini, North American representative for the Ibn Khaldun Center for Development, who's also working for democratic changes in Egypt. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's get a caller on the line. And this is Bill. Bill's calling from Alexandria, Virginia.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're on the air, Bill. Go ahead.
It appears to me what we're looking at is a failed Iraqi and Middle East policy. And what the administration is trying to do is to stabilize the whole Middle East in order to cover up a bad situation. And I think it's putting us in peril as American people, because with the Middle East in disarray, our oil suppliers are going to be in trouble. And American people are going to find higher oil prices and more difficulty in getting energy sources from that area. So what I'm thinking is that what's happening is that this is a cover-up for a bad policy that should have been abandoned.
Well, Nadia Bakhirji, people in Saudi Arabia certainly have their problems with American policies in Iraq. How do they view this electoral process in Iraq? Do they see it as real change or as something that is, as Bill says, designed to cover up a failed policy?
Well, I think there's a lot of mixed feelings about it. I mean, the whole on principle, the way that it's come about has been something that's caused a lot of concern. People haven't been happy with the invasion of Iraq, the loss of life on all sides, and enforcing democracy through power and through the way that it's been done is not something that I think would promote a good image for democracy in Saudi Arabia anyway. But I think they're hoping that it will work out.
Naim Sherbini, I wondered if you had a response to that point.
I came into it a bit late in the conversation, but basically, Neil, it's... A lot of intellectuals or elite in the Middle East think that, because Arabs do not have the standards of education necessary, then the process of democratization has got to be very slow. It cannot be done overnight. Point noted. However, I would say that if we look at India in 1947, the standards of education in India at that time were far below the standards of education of the Arab world, even in the 1950s and until all throughout until now. So India ended up being the largest democracy in the world. Why? Because there was a leadership that wanted to really live by democracy and introduce it on a large scale and stick with it. My own thinking is that the problem really lies with our leadership in the Arab world. If there is enlightened leadership, they would be willing to take chances with democracy. The idea that democracy is being imposed, of course, it's an abhorrent idea, but in terms of the Arab peoples themselves, whether in Saudi, in Egypt, in Lebanon, wherever, they yearn for having true representation. They are sick and tired of their rights being violated left, right, and center. So the what we need here is not so much a leap of faith as much as willingness on the part of the leadership to demonstrate to their people that they are from the people and for the people.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Omar is with us from Winchester, Virginia.
Hi, Neil, can you hear me?
Yep, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. I wanted to make a comment about Saudi Arabia having problems with American policy that you were just referring to, and I think that a large portion of the problems that not just Saudi Arabia but the Middle East, for that matter, has issue with is they're not interested in Iraqi democracy, and Wahhabism is very against Shiites. And there, in an example, Wahhabism really looks at Christians and Jews as someone who they feel is hostile to Islam, but they see Shiites as someone who is trying to change Islam, which enrages them, I think, even more than that. So I think that's probably a large part of the portion why a lot of terrorists are coming out of Saudi into Iraq. But beyond that, I think a democracy is going to have a very difficult time in general until Islam is not being hijacked by governments. As in, I don't think Islam has hijacked the governments. I think the governments in the Middle East have hijacked Islam, and I think it has brainwashed a large portion of people. And if you look at the Wall Street Journal's article today, they discuss Ms. Yaqub. She is now an elected person of the new Iraqi Congress, and she favors Iraqi men to have as many as four wives. She wants to repeal laws that guarantee alimony payments and child custody rights for women and divorces. I mean, these are issues that are going to make democracy, true democracy, very difficult when women's rights issues are not addressed and when the women themselves think that they don't deserve them.
Well, let's get a response from Saudi woman Nadia Bakhirji.
Yes. Well, I think it's sad that Islam should be used as a tool to manipulate certain people's agendas. However, when it comes to women's rights, this is one of the things that I feel very strongly about, and I felt that my participation at the local municipality level was elections was really important and valid, and that's why I put myself forward, because I think at this stage women should come forward. And but I do agree, some women are actually not for this empowerment, and sometimes, you know, we're not just fighting some archaic ideas. We're also up against our own kind. They don't believe that what we're doing is right. It can be very awkward. However, I believe that with time, a positive agenda to move forward, to empower women, to help the people's input into decision making will be taken into consideration on the long run, and Saudi Arabia is trying its best, I think, to, or at least it's making an effort, let's say, towards moving towards this. I'm a bit sad to hear what you just said about the lady in Iraq. I didn't realize that.
Omar, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And thanks to both of our guests. We really appreciate your time today. Nadia Bakhirji owns her own business, is a founding board member of the Arab International Women's Forum, which is based in London, and joined us from her home in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Thank you very much.
Thank you, too.
And Naib Sherbini is North American representative for the Ibn Khaldun Center for Development, and he was with us from Northern Virginia. And nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.